Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, my favorite guest, Richard Bowes, and it's his birthday. Stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Giants, when you come to think about it, are just plain inconvenient. They're big, they're loud, they're clumsy, they don't circulate well at parties. Really, if you can do without giants, you're better off. Director Rob Marshall is saddled with a giant in his adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods, and his handling of the behemoth reveals the shortcomings in his approach to adapting a stage musical to the screen. In a film loaded with computer-generated vistas, you'd think we'd get a little glimpse of the land of the giants, but Marshall is satisfied with the stage production's approach of having Giant Killing Jack played here, and very well by young Daniel Huddlestone, rush in and sing about his adventures. When we finally do see a giant, played by Frances de la Tour, who deserves better? She's out of focus and obscured by a network of branches, a technique one step removed from the show's approach of keeping the character off stage and only heard. It appears when presented with an opportunity to bring a visual solution to a challenge, Marshall is at times loath to fully engage his cinematic instincts. Like Little Red Riding Hood, he's reluctant to stray from the path laid him by the authors. This is especially a problem in Into the Woods' third act, which takes on what was the second act of the stage show. There's been a bit of tampering by the studio Disney here to downplay the key point of the main characters, who include not only Jack, but also Cinderella, Rapunzel, two Prince Charmings, a Wicked Witch, satisfied with their own alleged happy endings, throwing most of the plotting onto the threat of the giant instead. Marshall can't quite find an elegant way to handle the tampering. At best, it leads him to some very awkward character beats. At worst, it results in a disastrous treatment of the deaths of two key characters. But, and this is an important but, that doesn't mean this film is worthless. Far from it. This is still Sondheim, after all, and even defanged to the extent it is, there's still a lot of bite to a story that sees the classic characters and morals of fairy tales collide and interact in novel ways. James Lapine is responsible for the book and the screenplay, by the way. If Marshall stumbles or comes up short here and there, it's not for lack of respect or enthusiasm for the material, and the production, at the very least, is atmospheric and lovely. The cast, which includes Anna Kendrick as Cinderella, Lilla Crawford as Little Red Riding Hood, and Meryl Streep as the witch, is almost uniformly excellent, and James Corden and Emily Blunt as the baker and his wife are worth special note. They're essentially the fulcrum of the film, and they're very good. Only Johnny Depp as the big bad wolf feels a little out of place here, but he's not around long enough to throw things off too severely. It should be noted that the stage version of Into the Woods had some shortcomings to it. Sweeney Todd arguably remains Sondheim's masterpiece, and Tim Burton's adaptation arguably shows what a filmmaker can truly do in bringing a stage production to the screen. But the story is still engaging, the music still demonstrates a master's hand in expressing character through song, and Into the Woods still serves as a strong argument that more musicals should be brought to the screen. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews on my Mighty Movie Podcast website. So if you want to catch up on what you missed, please go to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Okay, Dan. Dan Persons, pardon me while I get my keys. That's what you're hearing. Had all that broadcasting from my keychain. Dan Persons will be the guest next week, which a show we actually wanted to do in December, which would be sort of the year end in media and a preview of the coming year in media, science fiction, and fantasy. And, oh, Dan, we're going to have words. I loved the movie. I was so afeared that they were just going to totally emasculate this dark, dark story. This arguably darker than Sweeney Todd, a movie that, despite my liking Tim Burton, I did not care for because I thought it took all the humor out. Rick was just telling me, and Rick is also... you're not a Sondheim fan, but you certainly know Sondheim.
I like Sondheim stuff.
I mean, I'm fanatic. I am.
You're a fanatic, yes. You're a Sondheim crazy person.
Yeah.
But I thought...
You could drive a person crazy. Sorry, could, Sondheim.
Absolutely. Yes. He said it, and he could probably do it. But
yeah, to himself, if nowhere else.
Yeah. I thought that the movie was good. I thought it had the same problems that the stage production had, which was that there's about half hour worth of the second act there that is just misery.
And you see, that's the part that I like.
You are a Sondheim person.
That's where we differ.
I remember seeing the original production, and it was either previews are very early in the run because nobody really knew what it was going to be about. And the first act is basically retold fairy tales, and quite jolly in its way.
Something that you have done in
something
a
I've
book
done myself.
That came out last year.
Right. I certainly have done that. But everyone
I was trying
at
to get
intermission.
You to mention your book so people can
well,
run
the,
out right now.
The Queen
at 1:30
the Queen.
In the morning and
right, right. Just, well, they can get them from Amazon. The Queen and the Cambion. But that isn't an adaptation of fairy tales. That's
a read.
Those are real fairy tales written by an actual fairy. And
but I'm
yes.
And speaking of Sondheim, now because the Baker and his wife are original creations, actually of James Lapine more than Sondheim.
Well, it reminded me when I first saw it of the Strauss opera Die Frau unschatten, the mm-hmm. woman without a shadow, more than any grime fairy tale or anyone else. That was what I thought of.
I actually know that work, and I would agree. I grew up with German opera, and
that's what's happened. I knew there had to be something.
Well,
awful.
My first operas, like many kids of German descent, Hansel and Gretel.
Well, absolutely, and not just German. That was the first opera I ever saw when I was a little kid.
Yeah. But my mother could tell me about all the different folk songs that originated.
Well, one of the things in the Humperdinck opera is some of them are folk songs, and some of them are folk songs that he invented.
Right.
And
he and his sister.
You're right, and it's hard to tell them apart. I mean, there's nothing much else that he did that's achieved great fame, but that opera is Really quite beautiful.
I saw a production of that at City Opera, RIP, that was just the closing of Act 1, or actually Act 2, the Sandman
right.
sequence.
Yeah.
They set the opera in New York City in the year that the opera actually came out.
Which is like the 1870s and 80s.
Something like that. Yeah, and the Woods sequence is in Central Park, and what they have are all the nannies, ghostly nannies, pushing prams, and they are hovering over the stage.
I've seen pictures of that.
I got shivers from that.
There are certain operas... And that's one of them. Magic Flute is another one. Tales of Hoffman.
My other
in which
two favorites.
The cunning
and Rosenkavalier.
Right, the cunning vixen, in which you can do whatever you want. You can fantasize the things. You can use puppets. You can have
Cunning Vixen. That was an animated version of the Janáček. Yeah.
Was there an animated?
Well, I've only seen.
It began
two
as a comic strip. Cunning Victim began as a Czechoslovakian comic strip.
Oh,
it was kind of the Pogo of Czechoslovakia.
Oh, my God.
Was then turned into an amazing opera in which, you know, there are people playing the parts of bees and things
yeah.
like that. But
seriously.
Right. With Magic Flute, with a few others, with Hansel and Gretel, you can change it. By popular agreement, it's all right to change these things.
Yeah.
And then other operas.
Although Magic Flute, for some reason, is so often Christianized, like the George Powell movie production and so many of them.
Well, the Magic Flute has...
Well, it's got its Masonic issues, yeah.
It's got Masonic issues, yes, as we say. The Masonic problem.
Yes. Not Messianic, but...
Yes.
Actually, it has a sort of Messianic problem as well. Sarastro and all.
Well, the problem, the thing with Magic Flute, is I don't really much care what it is. The music is wonderful, and there are scenes that are very nice. I must have seen it in various productions 20 times in my life, and I still have no idea what it is that's happening. And it doesn't bother me.
I like there are actually two filmed versions that are very good.
There's the one that was actually filmed in the Royal Opera House in Stockholm. That's directed by the person
yeah. after whom this radio show is named, Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah, Ingmar Bergman. Yeah.
And the idea that Ingmar Bergman, well, he directed a great deal of opera on stage.
Yes.
But
yes.
this used to be
one of the things. Movie directors at some point in their career became opera directors. John Huston spent a period of time as an opera director, and he was supposed to be just awful, as you kind of would think that he was going to be.
Annie? Come on.
Right, but he did.
Although one of the best reviews of the new version of Annie was John Huston, come back, all is forgiven.
Yeah, well, you know. he looks like a genius at this point. Now, what was I intended, actually.
We have to get back, because you've got two stories.
I have two stories. One of them is very short, and the other is not very long, but these are two stories.
Is there any particular music I should try to get, or should I just...
No, you just go with the flow.
Okay.
Both of these I wrote very recently, and one of them is out already, from Uncanny. It's in Uncanny number 2, and that's a brand new magazine put out by Linda and Michael Thomas. And
they're the editors.
They're the editors, publisher. They had a very successful Kickstarter, mm-hmm. and they began this magazine. And it has an excellent lineup. It's Maria Devana Headley is in there, Kat Howard, Amelia Beamer, Chris Ooh. Barzak.
Good people, all.
Absolutely. That's in the first issue. There's Sam Miller and Ken Liu, Sonny Moraine and ML Elmota are in the
that's
second
the
issue.
That's the first name I don't know.
Sam Miller?
No.
which name you know?
The last one you said.
ML Elmota?
That's
Yeah, she's...
Oh, wait.
Yeah, you do
no,
know
I do,
her.
I
you
do know her. What's more, I met her.
Yes, I see. Well,
yes. Very good singer, this, too.
That's
yes.
right, and that's a terrific right. tap dancer, but...
No, I'm serious about the singer. I don't
yeah,
know
she
about
is.
The...
Yes. Anyway, despite they had that, but they also have a very short story by me, and I am going to read that to you, whether you like it or not. And it's called Anyone with a Care for Their Image. And I will read that now. Today, without trepidation, I sent my beloved Marquette out to the city. Checked her hair, ringlets still perfect, her gown, modeled on that worn by the Princess de Polignac at the crowning of Napoleon III, remained flawless. I murmur, old age is ripe with memories that should have taught me not to do the foolish things that I know I will always do. Should I use that, she asks, in that charming voice with just a hint of huskiness? Only once, so make it count, I say. And she winks a dark eye, which still delights me, despite the fact that I program voice and wink. Then off she goes to the early autumn opening of the shamefully extravagant and wildly popular Flower Exchange. Marquette, with her bright smile and bon mots amid the mad money, would be carried on my sight in the late afternoon. These days, in the New York we call the big arena, anyone with a care for their public image has an automata they can dispatch to fulfill tiresome social obligations. If they have taste and a concern for the aesthetics of the other attendees, a doll in full costume, mid-19th century French is now the rage, is the only reasonable choice. Alternatives exist. Harriet Holways, whose blog site is at best a gossip sheet, has the frog footman. My dear friend Rupert Le Rupert has the tiresome bicycle messenger with bike, but most often, it's a life-size doll, arrayed in uncomfortable fashion, which no human would now suffer. It's best not to skimp. Some hell dolls from a few years back, with their silver fangs and red eyes, are still with us. But they no longer evoke the excitement their owners felt when they thought they were making a subversive statement. They pretend otherwise, but they've paid a price. The horrible Grebnitz, whose ego dwarfs the size of his website's viewer base, is an example. At this summer's perfume night, his hell doll attacked a security bot and got itself arrested. Grebnitz had to spend that evening and lots of money springing her. He had somehow managed to forget that legally our dolls are our dependents and we are responsible for them. Today, in my live blog, I played films and commented on famous old-fashioned shows like Trans Formation at Giants Stadium, with even the defensive ends in evening gowns, and the time when Lorimar, last of the billionaire mayors, froze Central Park Lake in midsummer and the models skated. I don't draw the highest density crowds, but 100,000 hits for a blog site on a weekday afternoon is quite nice, and I achieve that often. Sadly, I find that today the media is jammed with news of another failed coup attempt. Rage permeates the net. Grebnitz is a ravening beast and takes this latest attempt to overthrow the president as proof positive the nation is in collapse and that we should rise up. He doesn't understand that in a public dispute not of one's own choosing and beyond one's control, it's best to find some aspect that's transient and a bit silly. Politics, normally, provides plenty of opportunities of this kind. A posture of amused despair is a more durable commodity than rage, and it makes the inevitable backing down an occasion for amused smiles rather than gunfire. One's personal feelings are intrusive. We are all bystanders, especially since the government was moved to the West. Colorado, is it? Not Nevada, I know. Not Utah, I think. The coup, in fact, just a form of attention-grabbing? I think most people would like to believe so. Wanting often makes it true, and tomorrow is another world on the net. So what I say on the blog, perhaps not entirely wisely, is truth is too precious to spread around, and in any case is not widely appreciated. Lies, on the other hand, are cheap, easily manufactured, and generally a delight to all. It seems to me the kind of saucy wickedness my audience has come to expect. But immediately, I have that feeling of being a fool, which comes when one chooses the wrong moment to tell the truth. Luck, I tell the audience, is God's little compensation for those of us born without brains. But my audience is under 25,000 and falling fast. It's the moment when I want desperately to switch to the flower exchange. But what appears seemingly everywhere is footage of blood on a city street and the vice president, what's her name, being rushed somewhere in an ambulance. When the flower exchange finally appears, one sees the board with snow orchard futures and black tulips at prices that would support entire towns through eternity, but these numbers are not rising. The usual mobs of bidders and bettors seem to have faded away. My Marquette is on camera speaking to a reporter. She gives my name and tells the world he believes one has a blog site first and is a human being somewhere down the list. I have described myself thusly, but it's not what the moment demands. The interviewer is offended. I notice a Heldol in the background, and then another, and another. I try to contact Marquette, but they surround her, tear her clothes, and rip out her hair. There seems to be no security. Then a tinkling bell sounds, and Rupert LaRupert's bicycle messenger, backed up by several formidable bots, pedals into the picture, snatches Marquette up, and rides away. The messenger brings her to me with her clothes and body in tatters. Marquette's hair has been slashed. Chunks have been ripped off. Her eyes are shut, but her head is intact, which is what counts. Even in my distress, I envision new strategies for the two of us. The dark comes early in late September. On the net, mobs battle. The police and National Guard in a dozen cities. Something is on fire up the avenue from my building. Rupert's messenger also carries a note naming a street and a pier on the Hudson. A powerboat will take a few of us away for a while. More than ever, I am amazed at how worthwhile it was to secure a helicopter seat for young Rupert back when the water riots broke out and we all had to escape. I prepare quickly. Cards and cash are always on hand. I pack a very fine old brandy for Rupert and slip into a black jacket bought in a long-ago clearance sale for its very anonymity. I wrap a silk scarf over Marquette's battered face and zip her head up in a well-padded shoulder bag. Her data and systems are intact. She'll be tougher in her next incarnation. The aesthetics of combat wear will be new to us both. I apply every lock and safety device and walk down all the flights of stairs because power will fail at some point and elevators are traps. The lobby is dark. The doormen have fled. They and electricity are untrustworthy servants. I whisper for Marquette not to worry and that with a new body and wig, she'll be brighter than ever. We slip out the back door and down the service alley. Fire trucks with a police escort scream by as we emerge onto the side street. Smoke hangs in the air, upsetting, but not in a class with the water riots. The river is but a few blocks away. Now I flee, but soon I'll be back and spitting out epigrams on the net. Other formats could attract more attention than my blog. I could go totally live and have a bloodthirsty audience, watch Marquette and me scuttle down dark streets in search of safety. But even thinking about that produces shortness of breath and scary ripples in my heart.
Great fun to be mean to me. You shouldn't, for can't you see? way through. Why do you act like you do? You're mean to me. Why must you be mean to me? Oh, gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me crying. Please tell me why I stay at home each night when you say you'll phone. You don't, and I'm left alone, just singing the blues and sighing. You treat me coldly each day in the year. You always scold me whenever somebody is near, dear. It must be great fun for you. Can't you see what you're doing to me? Please tell me why.
Both of these magazines, where in which I had have or will have in the near future stories published, are new magazines. Uncanny is in its second issue at this point. It comes out every other month. And I think has the potential to be a very hot and successful online speculative fiction venue. At least I hope it does. The other story was written for Farrago's Wainscot, which went out of business in 2009, or suspended publication in 2009.
Suspended publication.
And has come back.
And I'm very pleased by that, because it was always, and I hate it when editors say, oh, there will never be another issue of blank. Never say never.
Right.
You know, I suspect in the future there will be another issue of Electric Velocipede. There will be possibly another Sybil's Garage. There, you know.
It's possible. What happened?
And there should be, by the way.
Well, these were the zines, and the zines had a definite start time and lived their lives and then started to go away. The one that began it all, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, is still with us. But it's not central as it was in a strange sort of way. For a while in the...
For like its first 15 issues, yeah.
For a while in the early 2000s, the zines were very important in the genre, and every aspiring young writer had a zine. And, you know, Kelly and Gavin had preach the zine gospel.
Kelly Link and Gavin Grant, for those.
Yes, for those who don't know this. I'm sorry, yes, Kelly.
Yeah, it's broadcast.
Right, it's broadcast. And
there could be somebody in a donut shop.
They could be anybody, but in fact, they're Kelly Link and Gavin Grant,
yeah.
And that's more than enough for them. But last year, at about this time or a little later, Electric Velocipede ceased publication. And that was the only other one of the zines that remained. I mean, what constituted a zine? I mean, it's kind of strange.
How would you define Clockwork Phoenix?
Clockwork Phoenix...
Which is, you know, still coming out.
Well,
with...
Clockwork Phoenix is something... It's like a small... It's a small magazine. It's a it's more poetry... centric than many of the others.
And also it comes out when Mike Allen feels the need.
I've never thought of it that way. I never heard him describe it as a zine.
Now, I guess it's an anthology.
And
then he's got
a poetry magazine.
Mythic Delirium.
Right, a poetry magazine.
Yeah, which is now no longer just a poetry magazine.
Right, now he has fiction in there also. I suppose, yeah, you could
There's
say...
There's also cross-genres. Is still...
No.
No?
No.
No what?
Cross-genres is a publishing house.
They have a zine.
Cross Genres has never claimed to be a zine. What way are they a zine?
They come out with regular issues with guest
that's
editors.
Not the sign of a zine. That is. What about fantasy and science fiction? They come out regularly. They have
that's
editors.
A prozine. These are semi-prozines, like the one I work for, which is Lightspeed.
The zines are, by definition, I suppose, not professional.
Right.
On some level. But in fact, if they weren't, they wouldn't have lasted more than two issues.
They often pay pro rates. Clark's World has just crossed over somehow from being a semi-prozine to a prozine. What right. defines the difference? I think it's the number of years that you've been paying professional rates.
I don't know.
As defined by the Science Fiction Writers of America.
I guess. I have no idea.
I'm not sure. I'll have to ask Neil or Kate the next time.
The only connection I have with this is when I get paid.
I work on the podcast for Lightspeed Magazine, which won the Hugo Award this year.
Yes.
So,
and even deserved it. But
we think so.
The thing with Farrago's Wainscot is that it was one of my favorites of the zines, maybe my favorite zine. And in a fit of madness, they used some of my toy photos in the store. Yes, which had never happened before. It's going to happen again. The doll anthology that Ellen Datlow is working on has some of my doll photos.
I would hope so. She should. You remember Sidney Smith?
Yeah.
Here of WBAI, he has some amazing doll photos.
I can just imagine. Yes,
you've seen them. You've seen them. You and he once practically you didn't make it into Master Control for the show because you were looking talking
right.
about Barbie outfits and years
yes.
and stuff
that
like
was
that.
A disgraceful period of my life.
Yes.
Yeah, the mutilation of Barbie dolls is something of a minor art form. But at any rate, I was very happy that Farrago's Wainscot came back. And it's, at this point, affiliated with Resurrection Press.
Ah.
And it pays professional rates and is in no way, in that way, is not like a traditional zine. Because one of the things about the zines was that they usually didn't pay very well. And that was part of the amateurishness of it. The story that I wrote for them actually is of the same ilk. I'm writing a whole bunch of stories set in a future New York. There's one that was published by Tor.com called Sleepwalking Now and Then, which is about a play production, a interactive play production, put on in an old hotel on the east side of Manhattan, where in the old days two murders were committed. And the play is, I suppose it's Sleep No More, actually.
Right.
But Sleep No More or Then She Fell.
Which is Then She Fell? Is that Alice?
That's Alice, and that is still on in Brooklyn. It's out in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
And I've seen it. It's I liked it very much. I liked it more than Sleep No More, which I had.
But Sleep No More sort of like started the concept, didn't it?
I think it popularized it. I mean, this stuff had always gone on, but yes, in which the audience wanders around and various things happen around them, and it has more in a lot of ways to do with haunted house productions than anything else. I remember the thing with Sleep No More. The idea of Sleep No More is it's supposed to take place in an old abandoned hotel, but instead actually takes place in a warehouse that had been over there on the west side forever, and it's full of like broken furniture, and you go through the furniture drawer, you find manuscripts in the furniture drawers. The thing it reminds me of actually is Ellen Datlow's apartment.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Speaking
of broken dolls.
Right, 100, some of which I've given her actually, but it's like Ellen Datlow, if apartment times 100. But anyway, yes.
And I'm sure that many of our listeners have
that experience. Anyway, yes, I
put her place is amazing. Let me just
that's
tell
one way to describe it. Yes,
it really
it's
is.
True. It's the health department ever finds out, she'll be shut down.
But, all of the awards that are scattered between
those horrible world fantasy busts of Lovecraft
and usually a kitten staring out from between them.
Yeah, cats running around.
Oh yeah,
yeah. No, it's
getting to high places that Ellen can't reach usually.
Right. But anyway, I did do a series of stories, or am doing a series of stories set in a future New York, in which it's called the Big Arena, not the Big Apple. And it's a more desperate, even more desperate New York than the one that exists now. And that, the story I just read, anyone with a care for their image is set in that. And this other one
So can we assume that this is a future book?
Possibly. It depends.
And if you're building all these stories in this universe...
Well, if you're building all these stories, then you have to find somebody silly enough to actually publish the thing. See, that's the other part.
Well, you've been pretty lucky at that. You have quite a few books out.
Well, the first three books that I had published, they were the first three pieces of speculative fiction I ever wrote. And they were through novels. I mean, they, had a beginning, middle, and end, and I wrote them as novels. And they came out in 1986, 87, and 88.
But Minions of the Moon changed that.
Minions of the Moon, well, what happened was the paperback original was you couldn't just walk into a publisher and they'd say, oh, give me a paperback original. And I started writing short stories, and I had enormous luck with the short stories, but I then began writing like semi-autobiographical stories with a character called Kevin Grierson, who was, in more ways than not, me. And it was his trials and tribulations as an alcoholic and a junkie and a child prostitute and all of the other fun things.
I knew the moment I looked at you that this was Kevin Grierson. Yes,
this was Kevin Grierson. Yeah. I looked into my own eyes and I saw Kevin Grierson, and that was published by Tor and had a nice career. I mean, it was reprinted.
It's back in print now.
Yeah, reprinted by Letha Press, mm-hmm. who then also did another.
A news story.
A news story, a bunch of stories, like 15 short stories in this case, called Dust Devil in a Quiet Street.
Right.
And again, it's me, and again, it's the trials and tribulations of being a middle-aged speculative fiction writer. But in between those, I also wrote From the Files of the Time Rangers, which was a whole bunch of stories about time travel.
And gods.
And gods, yes, gods, time travel, and me. Also, I was in there too. But yeah I haven't written
without the winged feet.
Without the winged feet, yes.
You were the one without the winged feet. Yeah.
No, I was the one with the winged feet.
Oh, you were?
Oh, yes, you did.
I didn't realize you were that mercurial.
Mercurial, yes.
Sorry.
But yes, that's what I've been doing for the last 20 years or so, is writing short stories and then stringing them into a novel. But yes, I will certainly.
Because it sounds like if you're doing this particular universe, as it were,
it's because
future New York, it seems like it should be bound together at some point.
I would hope to do that, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see how many of them I manage to write before they take me away. But yes, that's what the story that I read and this one amount to. The thing with Uncanny, as with the John Adams magazines, is that there will be podcasts, there will be all of the ancillary forms will be used in these things. And I think that is the way of the future. It is, I think, a way for magazines to make money, because certainly the old print magazines are not...
Yeah, but the John Joseph Adams magazines are published online for free.
Right.
And the podcasts are available online for free at lightspeedmagazine.com. I'm the host and audio editor. And I do the post-production. It's produced by Skyboat Media. And the But people do apparently pay for the e-books.
Yes. Right. And the rest of it is advertising for the e-books.
And there's also, before I was involved, there was an audiobook collection of the first year of Lightspeed magazine. So there's an audio book. There are stuff people can buy, but all of it is available for free.
Right, is available for free, but in certain formats you have to pay for it.
Yeah,
and somehow they make a profit doing this. I don't understand it.
I don't know. I appreciate the profit because it trickles down.
The trickle down thing.
And in the case of my salary, it's trickle indeed, but no, but I love doing it, so I get it's more than I get paid for working for WBAI.
You're not paid for doing this?
You think?
Does anyone get paid?
Yeah, nowadays about 6 people, down from 50.
Wow, we have,
I believe, we have 6. Well, if you add the part-timers, I think it comes to 7 full-time employees, which includes a bunch of people earning partial salaries.
Partial salaries.
Yeah. And we're supposed to move again.
Really?
Yeah.
To where?
388 Atlantic Avenue.
Oh, Brooklyn. Well, that's the last you'll ever see of me.
You know, it's a lot closer than this is.
That's true.
It's a lot.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true, yes. Well,
perhaps. And I'll still drive you, so what's the difference?
Oh, well, if you'll still drive me.
Yeah, of course.
Be any
of course.
Place. But anyway, it's bringing out a magazine at this point is... I remember when I was...
And yet they're doing well. I'm so pleased by this because...
And they're proliferating.
Because it's, to me, where... When I started reading science fiction, it was Galaxy Magazine and the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, which is still around.
Astounding,
which became Analog, which right. is still around.
Right.
Later years, Asimov's. The Digest magazines are my
right.
original
and
era.
And there still are the three, FNSF and Asimov's and Analog. And obviously they make money because otherwise they wouldn't be with us.
And in addition to that, now you have the zines that you're talking about, many of which pay professional rates, many of which are very good, like Clark's World, like the one I work for, Lightspeed, and Nightmare Magazine for horror and dark fantasy, although God knows we do our share of dark fantasy. I also edit the audio for the horror. There are a good... And then there are the podcast only, like yes. Escape Pod. They're mostly yep. doing reprints or retellings of yep. stories already published. And these are all doing very well. The Escape Pod people have 3 podcasts alone.
Right, I'm...
Escape Pod, Pseudo Pod, and something else pod.
Castle Pod, something.
Yeah.
There's, I can't even remember.
They're good.
Yeah, no, the...
Starship Sofa.
Starship Sofa, yes.
I mean, there are several of these, and yep. to me, these are, to today, what the Digest magazines were in the 60s.
Yes, plus you still have the Digest magazines, although how much longer?
Yeah, well, there are only 3 left,
right.
really. Whereas in the 60s, there were at least 8.
At one point, the first time I ever read science fiction, I was about 9, 10 years old, and it was in Boston, it was in Dorchester, in Codman Square, and there was a store that... You know, it was a corner store, and it had a Coke freezer, and it had,
yeah.
you know, candy, and they had...
No soda fountain?
Hmm?
Did
no,
they have a soda
no,
fountain?
No soda, no.
Oh, that's a small place, then.
Had all the newspapers, and there were like 7 newspapers in Boston at that point. But They had all of these science fiction. They also had, you know, detective magazines, but the covers were torn off.
Right, yes.
Which
remainders.
Meant that remainders, and they shouldn't have been selling them. But
that's right.
For various reasons, the man who ran the place liked to have kids around because it looked as though he had a business.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, the business took place downstairs. There was a betting parlor downstairs, and there were like seven or eight guys wearing, you know, eye shades.
If you go back years before that, these places were also the Speaks.
No.
Yeah.
No, the Speaks place. This was Boston. I know.
New York, in Brooklyn.
Speakeasies were places that were bars.
Right, but there were places that you could go and retail. These weren't places that you went to drink. These were places that you could go to buy
alcohol.
Wine
right.
or beer
right.
or gin to take home.
Right.
Or
and
some
that,
brown liquid,
right,
they would call it whatever you
that
wanted.
That was illegal. It was, strangely enough, it wasn't illegal to buy it. It was only illegal to sell it. Which,
right.
That was the paradox of the
yes.
prohibition.
Yes, exactly.
But I was taken.
Barbara Kresnel did a great deal of research
right,
on these places.
A somewhat older child took me around back, and we looked in the window, and there were guys on telephones and saying, it's running wet at Hialeah, you know, they'd be saying it. And that was quite
running wet on the nose.
Yeah,
yes.
On the nose at Hialeah. Anyway.
Sounds like Damon Runyon.
Well, David Runyon was a naturalist on some level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sentimentality is his, but the characters are the kind of characters that were hanging around. I mean, in that way, he was telling the truth.
Oh, yeah. He owned a place himself, so, you know, when he was a sports writer, so.
Yeah. Yes. Well, anyway, shall I read Florago's Wainscot? Or you want
I think you should.
Okay.
Now, how long will that run?
Well, it's like 3,000 words, so I think it'll run probably about 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, then it's definitely
doable.
Doable. Yeah, it's 2:20 in New York City now.
My God, the time flies when
And during
fun.
That reading, I'm going to warn you, I'm going to leave the room for a couple of minutes.
Could you bring me back a glass of water?
Yes, I certainly can.
Well, that's good. Then you can leave forever, as long as you bring back the water.
But so outside of what you have told us already, is there anything we need to...
To know beyond that, no. It's set in the same world as the other. It's a different narrator. I'm very happy that they bought this thing. I'm happy that this particular zine has come back to us. I would like there to be some more. Probably they don't want there to be more, but I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased to have, first of all, to have two stories come out. This will be out the...
Well, you had a very good 2014 in publishing.
Well, no, not particularly, because most of 2014, what I was doing was involved the books. 2013, I had four books that came out, and this was...
2013, you sold for... Didn't they mostly come out last
right,
year?
Right, 2013...
That's the problem with writers. They remember the sale better than the publication.
No, no. shoo, you're right. Yes, 2013.
Yes, you're remembering the sale.
I remember
when the books
came out. Well, that was the fun part. That was the fun part. The sale is the fun part. The bad part is when the book comes out.
Yeah.
Anyway, the four of them came out.
I'm very pleased that you had a very lucrative 2013, but I, on a selfish level, enjoyed reading the damn stuff when it came out in 2014.
Well, believe me, I didn't
You had like five books in 2014.
No, four. Four books.
Oh,
don't make
excuse
it worse
me.
Don't make it worse than it was.
That's
this was a mistake.
Good.
Well, I went to ReaderCon because I said, this is ridiculous. I haven't had a book published since 2005, whatever it was, 2006. And are all the small press people are there, and definitely I'm a small press writer. And I went to ReaderCon, and I sold The Queen, the Cambion, and seven others to Timmy Duchamp at Aqueduct.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold...
She's quite something. I've never met her.
She's a terrific publisher. It was a very, very.
And our next New York Review of Science Fiction readings, by the way, Jen Brissett, who was here about 2 months ago, Elysium, came out from Aqueduct.
I just read it.
I liked it.
Yeah,
I really did. And Carlos Hernandez will be reading with her.
Yeah.
And, but I don't know. I just knew that he had sold a book because he was publishing on Facebook a photo, and he said, "Does this look like something that belongs in a jacket of a book?" It's like, can you be more subtle, Carlos?
Right, he has a book of a collection of short stories coming out, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the house. Anyway.
Oh, well.
Okay. I went to ReaderCon and I sold The Queen, the Cambion, and seven others. And I sold to, I can't even remember the name of the publisher at this point. Oh, this is...
Which book? Maybe I'll...
If Angels Fight, Fairwood. I sold that. It's a collection of short stories. I sold that to Fairwood. And I sold to Letha Press, to Steve Berman at Letha Press. I sold Dust Devil on a Quiet Street. And a reprint of Minions of the Moon. And this was all quite jolly, and I went home feeling I had accomplished something. But then, of course, came the horrible thing that these books actually had to get published. I had to, you know, do proofreading, and Chris Dykeman was incredible. She, you know, helped me design covers for the thing. She designed covers for the thing.
She designed the logo for Hour of the Wolf. She's amazing
person. But it was a very busy year that way, and I didn't really get to write very many short stories, but one of them was Sleepwalking Now and Then, and the other one was for The Revelator, which is Stories I Tell My Friends.
And this is Matthew Chaney?
Matthew Chaney and Eric Schilling.
Right.
And I wrote a story for them, and it's not a speculative fiction. It's about me, so it is kind of a speculative fiction story. But yeah, my favorite subject, myself, and it's.
But these do not have any scientific or magical.
None really.
They're all based on the planet that we know.
Pretty
the planet
much,
called Boston.
Planet that I know anyway.
Planet and, Boston.
Yeah, and so those are the only two that I had out, and so the only one who's really that's up for awards at this point is Sleepwalking Now and Then. But anyway, that was my 2014 was crammed with running from place to place and doing readings and
radio shows
radio shows. Who could forget that?
Not I.
Why don't I read here?
If
there is an audience that's fallen asleep at this point.
Oh, not if they're listening to the stream later.
You think that's how they're going to get it? I suppose.
Yes, I do.
You don't think that there's an audience up at like 2 o'clock in the morning?
Well, on the live stream at the moment, there's all of 105, to be precise.
And we're sure they're all alive.
Well, they're streaming. They're being streamed to, I should say.
Yes, okay.
You know, what they're lying in, you know, whether it's wood or mattress, I'm not sure. But
yes, coffins full of thin-aided soil.
But at this moment, we're getting 105 people, but more people than that than get, the, you know, the stream's available on demand, and for the moment, it's available on download, which I hope will continue.
I would hope so also.
Yeah.
There's no sense in making it more difficult for the readers. Anyway, this is the story, Time is a Twisting Snake, from that will appear in Farrago's Wainscot a week from today. Actually,
ooh,
it's the 14th. Okay. Yes, so it'll be a week.
It won't be a week from today, though, if you're listening to
this. Oh, because this is like Thursday. So it was a week from yesterday.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So So for those people, it came out a week ago.
That's right. Right, I'm very old and I'm very confused. Okay, Time is a Twisting Snake, Section 1. Tragedy is just comedy without the laughs, Sydney, a bad old sugar daddy of my long-ago youth, used to say. I think of those words often. This story starts on one of those days in late spring
when the sun dances on small waves and a breeze blows in off the Atlantic. Even the air in the big arena, as they call New York, feels fresh and almost natural on the day of the city's annual marriage to the Atlantic. If I believed in any of the usual gods, I'd take it as a sign of divine approval that the joining together of legendary city and mighty ocean should occur on what would prove to be the most perfect of days in May. Establishing a tradition is hard. It took Venice a few centuries to attain the full grandeur of its yearly marriage to the Adriatic. The big arena hasn't been in the business of living in the arms of the ocean for nearly as long. We've been playing this marriage game for less than a decade. Here in the late 21st century, and bad weather has produced scanty attendance a few times. But today, last year's hurricanes and the images of Staten Island half submerged are behind us. With the heat blast of summer yet to come, crowds in party clothes jam the high seawalls of the Battery. We don't yet have a proper Bucentoro, that floating gold throne room on which the Doges of Venice sailed forth each year onto the Adriatic Sea. I stand on the deck of a garishly painted barge loaded with flowers and towed by a fireboat. The regatta accompanying us includes everything from sailboats to ferries and is larger than it's ever been before. In a silver cape and a fake bishop's mitre, I raise my arms with my palms open and pick up images. Then I turn 360 degrees and send those pictures of the blue waters and blue skies and the Statue of Liberty behind her sea gates to my wide net audience. People often ask how, considering my habits and proclivities, I've managed to survive into old age. My secret is simple. I've never done an honest day's work. By honest work, I mean the boring nonsense others make you do. Not stuff like today, which is more than a bit fly, and for which I'm being paid, but which I might almost have done for free. I roll the words out. We have surmounted snow and wind, blazing heat and floods, to come to you, O majestic Atlantic. We ask only to be one with you. On every side, palms open in my direction, and images and audio go out around the world. I know it's over the top, but I was one of the first to see this opportunity. I toss the wedding ring into the water as a chorus sings, music plays, the crowd cheers, and the ceremony ends. I'm towed back to Manhattan, feeling tired and in need of rest now that the drama is over. And each minute, the Bucentoro looks more and more like a freight barge. On the Battery seawall, correspondents with their palms up approach me. Lydia Greenglass cuts in front of all the rest, sticks a palm in my face. Do you really think that you're the right person to represent this city in a marriage with the Atlantic, she asks. This is a major ocean. Lots of people wonder why we couldn't find someone a bit more prepossessing to represent us. This is well beyond friendly banter. Her face looks different these days, younger. Work has been done. Her whole posture has changed. Now she's taller than I am. Lydia and I go back a few years, and relations have always been more or less harmonious. I try to treat this as a joke. My body is a temple, Miss Greengrass, I tell her, even if it's a temple that's been sacked and defiled by barbarian invaders. I have a public that finds my repartee amusing, or at least I did. She looks at me with real disdain, holds up her palm so her audience sees me up close. This is not a game, it's a challenge. We each have our following plugged into us. Mine, I am aware, is older, subject to attrition. Over the last few decades of hosting on the worldwide net, I've learned to judge an audience's size, the ebb and flow of brief visitors and longtime fans. I start to feel slippage. New York is deserting my network presence. My body may not look like much at this point, Miss Greenhell, I tell her, but over the years, thank God, I've proven to be very hard to kill. The crowd around us jostles for position. I know this city well enough to understand that the marriage is already ancient history. All palms face both of us as that part of the world that thrives on confrontation watches. Anyone Lydia said, who went to the bother of relieving us of the wreckage you describe as a body, should be regarded as a public benefactor. Around us, people gasp, people laugh. I imagine they're doing so all over the big arena. In my own defense, I will say, I'm tired and taken by surprise. That's an explanation, but not an excuse. A smile like a thin knife appears on Lydia's newly sculpted face. She strokes her smooth, tanned arms and bounces on red tennis shoes, the kind with springs and ball bearings that kids wear. She turns and walks away, taking most of the onlookers with her. Lydia is younger than I, but only by a decade or so. What I just saw, I realize, is the phenomenon they call an addition. This means that everything but Lydia's brain started out as another human being, a young one. She has had work done to make her host's face look more like hers used to. The common understanding is that an addition's brain and body are a team. Poloni is her body's name. She still calls it that. When they were united this winter, she told her friends, and I heard it from them and forgot. She described how young Poloni from somewhere in New Jersey sold her body so her family wouldn't starve. Her desire, Lydia said, was to make Poloni's features as beautiful as her soul. I catch sight of Lydia Greenglass on the net. She's being interviewed and shaking her head, formerly Poloni's head, in wonder at her enormous good fortune in acquiring the body that she believed had, from its birth, been intended by God to be hers. What bothers me most is that she wouldn't have attacked like that if she hadn't been sure that opinion was on her side. And I wonder if my time is over. My popularity is what brings me gigs like the one this afternoon. It's where my income comes from, where my life comes from. Dragging myself home, all I can think of is that it's over for me. I turn off the net, those incessant voices in my head, those images on my palms. I live in the old low-rise corner of Manhattan, full of life and illegal activity. But I'm too old and done to take part in any of this evening. I climb the stairs and fall face first on the bed. I awaken in the middle of the night from a dozing dream in which I have a prehensile tail and am quite smug about this somehow. I sleep again and dream again. I'm a shark, ever vigilant, never resting. Fins guide me through dark waters. That morning I wake up amid scattered fragments of images and lost words whispered into my subconscious. Out of habit, I flick on the net and say, more dreaming than I've done in years. The old don't need as many dreams as the young. And voices rush in to agree and contradict and tell me I'm not old and that Lydia is a monster. Few of them sound young. I make tea and toast and evaluate my holdings. What I own beside a nice enough apartment is my public persona. I'm the old New York from back before hurricanes flooded the subways and the seawalls went up. My voice was hoarse before its time. I sounded nice as a kid. I could sing. The current voice is that of the old wise-ass city, the voice of the guy with the racing forms at the diner counter, the voice of the Groucho Marx inside each of us, a lost New York voice. I get dressed and go outside. My apartment is in an old building on the ancient low-rise village. Skyscrapers with their conveniences and amazing views look down on us. But being 40 stories up when the power goes out and the elevators stop is to be trapped in a gilded cage. I live close to the seawalls that ring Manhattan Island. Young people play racquetball against them. Visitors sit outside cafes. Guides lead tourists through the old streets, babbling nonsense about past times. They bring them up rope ladders and over the walls, totally illegal, perfectly normal. Down the outside of the wall they'll go, and onto motorboats on the Hudson that will take them through the wetlands, the houses on stilts in Queens, and on the Jersey Shore, whole elevated towns devoted to pleasure. It's how the big arena supports itself. A police car rolls by, and a cop nods at me. Someone across the street waves my way, and I have a palm up, showing the sunny morning. I'm at work as I walk, taking it all in, looking for an angle I can slide through. I pass close to the seawall where tourists look through windows onto the lordly but treacherous Hudson. I walk further, and it's young people, locals maybe, playing racquetball against the wall. It seems like there are more kids around here than I've seen since I was one and fresh in the city. Something feels familiar. I stand still, look closely at the players, and notice the active bodies, the old lizard eyes. A good number of these are additions. It reminds me of Lydia, and I start to move away. But as I do, one lithe young lady catches a rebound, looks my way, and nods. She's a stranger, or so I think, until I find something familiar, the shadow of somebody I remember, in her eyes. It takes a few minutes, but I recognize an old boon companion, a bit more than a friend, if less than a dream lover, in days gone by. Mark, I say, and wait for this particular addition to call time, motion a replacement into the game, and then to walk over and hug me. I'm a little reluctant, and Mark is a little amused. We sit down at an outdoor cafe and exchange recent histories. Mine's pretty simple, I tell him. I'm doing the same things I was when you left for other parts, except I'm older and more tired. But you? I want to ask where he's been and how he's come to be what he is. The face, young and dark, smiles at me. It's not the face I knew, except the eyes, which are brown, not blue, but somehow are his. He tells me how he traveled the world, looking for a place that seemed able to adapt to the changes happening to the earth. Matilda and I met in Brazil, and I convinced her that aside from the initial cost of the operation, two of us could live as cheaply as one, he said, and I have a feeling there's a lot more to the story. We drink quite a bit of wine that long afternoon. Mostly, I call myself Mark Matilda, because she's so much of what I am. The voice is a warm purr. I saw your wedding yesterday, and all that followed? You were flummoxed, and I was surprised. The man I remember wouldn't have let her pull that. I don't like the way she presents herself, and I didn't like the way she treated you. But I had a feeling it was her transformation that got you rattled, and that surprised me. I think this would have fascinated the man I once knew. I'm old, I tell him. Mark Matilda smiles, and I remember that this exotic person isn't that much younger than me. We talk about ourselves, and I find myself telling him my dreams, the prehensile tail, the shark swimming. We grow or we die, is what the dreams tell you, he says, and you don't want to die. The city needs you. We all do. When you get old, you're seduced so rarely that it's not immediately recognizable when it happens. I remember, Mark Matilda says, how decades ago a certain citizen would get on the net, back in ancient times, when most of us still weren't internally wired. It was like the streets, the curbstones themselves were talking, obscene, gritty, brutally funny. The voice talked us through the freshwater riots, that awful winter in New York. We had two mayors at the same time, and their supporters fought in the streets. The cops remember. The one turning me said, I saw them salute you this morning. What are you going to say when people want you to lead? I'm sorry, but I've got an appointment to die of old age. There's a way for you to live. I look at the young people and suddenly can easily spot the additions among them. Maybe soon it will be everyone in the big arena, except me. I ask what it's like to go through the process, and Mark Matilda tells me. There are lots of moments, like the one where you wake up a tiny bit and are aware of the one you love sleeping beside you, except it's closer than that. Section 3. There's no fool like an old fool, Sidney, my sugar daddy, used to say in the long-gone days, when one took pride in one's perversity. It is my belief that if you have never done, in old age, something that would shock your younger self, you are, in many senses of the word, already dead. For this year's marriage of the big arena and the Atlantic, we still don't have a perfect Venetian bucentoro, but we're a bit closer to it. The current barge is two stories tall. The gold is edged with scarlet, and spring flowers hang like sails on the jury-rigged masts. This year's aspiring bucentoro features a display of the city's current beauties. Some are simply themselves. That is to say, we boast a fine bevy of standalones, as those without an added life are currently called. But it's the additions, including myself and Tararo. One always mentions one's body, who capture the net's attention. Mark Matilda is among the most prominent. Also present is Lydia Poloni. Once I joined the ranks of the additions, Mark went out of his way to reconcile Lydia and myself, and she does seem a bit more subdued. Being close to her means that I am learning the ways of my adopted people. For instance, she and her friends are currently both upset and made envious by rumors of a new breed of additions. The very old and very wealthy in China are now supposedly uniting with young people who are genetically manipulated to develop powerful sets of lungs. This new model can function underwater for extended periods of time. Frankly, I don't see the point of this, and I'm much too occupied with getting used to having Tararo's body to want anything more complicated. Unlike Mark Matilda's description, life with him is not a case of waking with the realization I'm with someone I love. Mostly it's shock at feeling my young body bounce out of bed and land on my strong feet each morning after barely a hint from my brain. People say, it's awful when you get old and can't remember your own name. Nonsense. In the last year, forgetting who I was, amid the transplant operations, the endless physical therapy afterwards, allowed me a sense of removal, the ability to be a bystander and not an accomplice. It meant not having to wonder about the source of the seemingly endless line of young people willing to have their bodies placed under the command of important, connected, or wealthy old people. I, for instance, got paid to have the operation because Mark Matilda felt I'd be worth having, and being old and confused permitted me not to wonder or worry too much about the payback, except sometimes at night when I'm alone, I do. I don't say we, because despite what I was told, I never once have felt a trace of Tararo. When I hinted at this to Mark Matilda, the answer was a slight shrug as they stepped away from the conversation and me. For someone who has led a long life that hasn't been entirely straightforward, the additions evoke a certain deja vu. They combine memories of old-fashioned scams with the dark nostalgia of the invasion of the body snatchers. Forgetting things, which I happily do, allows me to stride up and down the deck of this overdressed barge, shaking hands and smiling. On this fine day in May, I'm the addition's most recent trophy. This would be fine, except for the lurking suspicion that I'm enmeshed in something stranger and stronger than I want to know. I wonder if Tararo, Matilda, Poloni, and the rest are, in fact, the names of those whose bodies we wear, and if anyone remembers what happens to those kids. Time is a twisting snake, ready to turn around and bite you. Was something else, Sydney, my sugar daddy, often said.
Sleep in your lady.
And then the show starts. But I do love that. I love the whole show. But
it's a great show.
That, and that's a wonderful recording.
It is.
A studio.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
Production. Yeah, it really is. So it, that was Samuel Raimi. Yeah. No relation to Sam Raimi, the movie director. Yeah.
Maybe he is. Who knows? But not.
But this was with Tyne Daly and Mandy Patinkin and all these perfectly cast.
Do you remember there's a CD? It's Leonard Bernstein's New York.
Yes.
That's a beautiful piece of...
Oh, and they do... that. My favorite thing on that CD is Patinkin and Tyne Daly and two others doing... what's that song? Some Other Time. We'll Meet Again Some Other
the
Time.
Thing is that the, I like best in, the thing I like best in it, it's a song that was cut out of Wonderful Town, and it's you walking in the park. It's a beautifully sad song. They can see how it was cut out of the show, but it's a beautiful, beautiful song. Yeah, I know. That's a beautifully made album, and so much of his music is New York. It's New York music. He only did four musicals.
He and Gershwin.
Right, basically. He only did four musicals, and one of those, I mean, Candide is not New York, but the other three are.
The other three are very much so, and Candide is, well, its own thing.
Well, it's someone's own thing, anyway.
I'll grant him the overtures, just Glitter and Be Gay
It has incredible things in it, but the number of people who worked on the lyrics for Candide is like everyone.
It's like a dozen plus Lillian Hellman and.
Absolutely.
Everybody.
John Latouche and. Yeah. Dorothy Parker.
Right.
And Stephen Sondheim.
That's right.
Pimple-faced,
practically, Stephen Sondheim.
No, when he did that, he had already had a couple of... He had a couple of successes.
Well, I mean, through...
He didn't do the original production. I mean, he was...
Oh!
It was a revival.
He worked on that revival. That would explain it, because when Candide came out, Sondheim would have been...
In his 20s.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Sure.
Well, let's see. He was growing up with Oscar Hammerstein.
Right.
And he was going to Hollywood writing for things like Topper.
That's right.
And he did this show, which in fact was revived recently. I saw an earlier production of it that's set in Brooklyn. It's like on a street corner, which is... pretty awful. Saturday Night, it's called. Saturday Night.
That's early Sondheim songs.
That's his first show.
No, it wasn't put on.
Oh, his first... Okay, I'm sorry. It was his first show that was staged.
No.
And... No?
No.
Which was his first stage show?
West Side Story.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
and
well, so I guess
he
I
owed,
saw
he
the
owed
first
a big
staging
thing.
Of
he owed
it
a big,
case.
He owed a big favor to Bernstein because... Bernstein helped him with the lyrics. Bernstein helped him link the lyrics to the music.
Ah.
And in return, apparently, then he went in the 70s for a production of Candide and redid some of the lyrics there.
That explains
some
gaps in my knowledge there. But that makes
sense.
But
yeah, he started West Side Story was the first thing.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because when people think of West Side Story, the first name that pops into their head is not Stephen Sondheim. It's Bernstein, it's Jerome Robbins,
he's the weak link.
He is.
I mean, the lyrics are bad. In a couple of cases.
But memorable.
For the wrong reasons. I mean, he has... And he talks about this. I mean, he has no feeling for... I mean...
But as a kid, I
loved... Had he ever seen
Officer
a Spanish
Krupke,
person?
You know,
yeah, I mean, stuff like that he could do. The problem he... I mean, originally what they were doing...
Was Irish...
Right, Abie's Irish Rose. Yeah. They were doing Abie's Irish Rose, except... You know, somebody said, hey, you know, this doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know. Hello, hello.
Hey, Lester. He sneaks in so quietly, so we have to say, hello, Lister. And you and Rick are old friends.
Glad to see you.
Good to see you.
And you are cold.
Really.
I can feel the cold.
Chill. Yes, you can come here and give me a kiss, for Christ's sake.
Happy New Year.
Likewise. And thank you for covering New Year's for me. That was great.
Naked body.
No, that comes after
that
you
comes
warm up.
Free. That's a free part of
the... Lister covered New Year's for me.
Well, the nice thing about radio is everybody could be naked on radio.
Well, I was just not up for a party show, and I knew that you would be right for that. So
why weren't you up for a party show this
last week? Starting at 1:30, I could have potentially. In fact, Kathy didn't necessarily. She wanted to pre-record something, so we wouldn't have had anything live. And I've done New Year's Eve on the air before, but you started to get it right. You start at 11 or 11:30.
You got to start drinking earlier.
I would have been driving here. So it was better to have Lister.
Yeah.
Just come in and do... it was a great show, thank you.
Great, thanks.
Yeah. And...
there it is.
Exactly.
There it is.
God
knows what it is, but there it is.
Yeah. And I feel like we're almost out of time. We've got about 2 minutes before
I start playing the outro. I have nothing to say.
Why don't you tell people your website, your books that they can get, or can they get are there links to all of your books on your website?
No, there aren't.
Phil,
you don't need that. All you need to know is Amazon. Amazon.com. My novel, Dust Devil on a Quiet Street, was nominated for the World Fantasy and the Lambda Awards last year. And you should go out and you should buy this because it's a really good book.
It's a great
and
book.
It is. It's a great book.
Listeners to WBAI will know the opening chapter.
They will know that.
There's a hole in the city.
There's a hole in the city, which has been my life support system.
It's a great story.
It is. It's a great story. The thing that's weird about it is, you know, I wrote it. It started just like any story. And then it turned out, no, this wasn't just any story. So that's out. And also I have a really, really good book of modern fairy tales called The Queen, the Cambion, and Seven Others. Which also came out. All my books came out last year. And I also have...
Not your first book, your fourth book, but...
Yeah,
Of the modern era of Richard Bowes.
Of Richard Bowes. Yes, it... If Angels Fight is also out. And Minions of the Moon is out. And you should go... All of the people, all 12 of the people listening to the show, should go out and buy all of these books. You don't even have to go out. You just get them on Amazon.
Okay. So, that right there is a clue. So, I'm just trying to, sign out here and get this all...
You mean we're off the air?
No.
We're on the air. God, this is the most...
We're still on the air, and we... And I know exactly how many people are listening through the internet. I have no idea for radio listeners, but...
Well, radio listeners, how many are listening on the internet?
102.
102 people with nothing better to do at this point?
This very moment, yeah. And then it actually multiplies by many factors as people wake up around...
And have children and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. But as always, I wasn't kidding when I said at the outset of the show that you are my favorite guest. You are.
Why, thank you.
You've always been my sort of go-to person. Although this time, this was one of the times where you said, I'd like to do another show.
I did say that. And
you
did. I
have
no idea why. But it turned out by the time I... Dude, the show, I actually had stories coming out and things like that. That wasn't true when I said I wanted to do the show. I don't know why.
That was only about a month ago.
It wasn't even that. It
wasn't even that?
No,
what was it at the...
Christmas,
no, it wasn't
it was at
the
your Christmas party.
That's right.
Yes, so it was like a few weeks ago.
Yeah, on the
20th. I decided, I wanted to do the show.
It wasn't a Christmas party. If I was holding it, it wasn't a Christmas party. It was a
Yule. If I attended it was a Christmas party.
No, I see. Okay, well.
Why wouldn't it be? Oh, you mean you don't think of that as a Christmas party?
No, no. Somehow so new, no.
So no, you don't.
I don't do a Hanukkah bush. I don't.
You don't.
No. I don't do Christmas.
Oh, I'm so disappointed.
It is Saturnalia. That or the Feast of Fools, or Yule. And there are a couple of other good, really bizarre holidays.
Yeah, there are many things
around.
It could
be. They all center around that time.
It's a magic. It's the moment of the winter solstice. And, you know,
it was the day after
basically the sun is going out.
Yeah.
And then it takes a couple of days before it becomes noticeably brighter. And December 25th would be like 4 days after the solstice, when there's like another 30 seconds of light.
Yes, yes,
so
exactly.
So, you know, Shmagooga, the night god, has decided not to destroy the world once again.
That's just the Shmagooga
life can
yes.
turn, yeah, Shmagooga.
You'll be happy for Shmagooga.
Yeah, Shmagooga, you know, we had to sacrifice a couple of babies.
Well,
once we burned a couple of babies, he turned the sun back on. And
and the sun said, thank you very much. I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Rick Bowes, B-O-W-E-S at rickbowes.com. And I'll be back next week with Dan Persons doing a media end of the year and beginning of the year program. And everybody, take care. Have a wonderful week. Try to be good to each other. It's tough times.
Stay warm.
And stay warm. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way over these same airwaves. Birthday, Rick Bowes.
Call me, but you want me in prison, 'cause I'm pissing your tax. The flag, I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a cymbal. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru. Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea. Beirut, can't forget Haiti. Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about uptown Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx. Yeah.
My man Joey to jail and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game, well I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you, I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave, land of the free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on, just a mother. You gave me freedom, but you stole me when I touched the flag. But I'm not scared of you. See, I made up this new rule, and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Lister on the radio.
Facing the crowd. Looking right at you, know you're better than
Lister Live. Your weed.
The things that you go.
The aeroplane.
Only in a day.
Mix me, Lister.
Your mama, you land.
Pussy marijuana. she go a man a drive, yeah, them a choppy. Lord, I'm also them a watch it.
Follow me now.
She love me and she love me so madly. And Jaja know, say she driving me crazy. Especially when she spot Philip and Robson Johnny. And when she spot Robert and the Apache. The girl a tell me, say she want the milk and she honey. She love me like how the fish them love her swimming on the sea. She love me like how pocket man it love some money. Come and take it from the cat them and the girls them dolly. And everywhere me go, the girl them getting honey. And I tell me, say them want the milk and not them honey. Come follow me now.
You better groom me.
When I'm on Waller, when I have her, now me arm. I tell her no from those, I miss her straight back till dawn. The loving and the kissing and them drink the water gone. And I know what that she gone, me miss her from out of me arm. Listen, miss her catch her from up down, still up down. I'm telling her no, it's a dolly, this a dolly, my baby. Come follow me, dolly, this a dolly, my baby. You shouldn't leave me and you leave me so lonely. And then you leave me and you're my one and only.
Groove me, groove me.
Dolly, this so dolly, my baby. I said she love me and she love me so badly. And then you love me and you love me so sadly. And then you leave me and you leave me so lonely. And Mr. Catimore, you're one and you're only. And if you leave me, I know I would die lonely. And if you leave me, I know I man would die slowly. And if you leave me and go, I know I man would die so surely. Cause baby girl, I know I love you and I love you badly. I said I love you like how the fish them just are swimming on the sea. But I love you like how the pocket just eat love money. I love you like how milk and me say it want honey. And I love you like how crib I eat a lover baby. And I love you like how poor man them love a jewelry. Come take it from me. Got him on the white lap of tree. And anyway, me go to my baby library. And we no dolly, show me dolly, my baby. Got him on the dolly, show me dolly, my baby. Dance and let love go, baby. Let love go, baby.
When you get a new class, the daddy. This bullada, I no party. You alone have the style, the daddy. The queen for England, have no backyardy.
Real bad man, no muggle in a shot. Straight G.